Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. That music sounds so good, I didn't even want to stop. Good morning, everybody. This is Jansen Brooks. We're with the Council of Elders call-in talk show today, Saturday, March the 12th of the year of our Lord, 2022. We have a great guest on the line for us today, folks, Mr. Dominique Bamonte of the Sacramento, California area. And certainly glad everybody's calling in today. Now, if you're listening and you have a question or comment for our guest, an observation for our guest, you can press the number one on your phone and we'll let you in for some a question or comment. Again, this is the Council of Elders call-in talk show, and my name is Jansen Brooks. Well, folks, just a little bit about the background of the Council of Elders. If you listen to the show, you know that it's a concept where elders in the community will try to reach out to younger people, help them navigate through life, help them solve some of their problems, some of their issues, and also listen to them so that we can solve some of our problems and issues. All right. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce our guest today, Mr. Dominique Bamonte. To read, if you would, a little bit of his bio. I feel like he's into so much that we could have a 2 or 3 hour show. But let me just tell you a little bit about him and for his bio before he comes on. Dominique Bamonte is a passionate educator and community servant. As a former foster youth, he has committed his life to mentoring African-American men and boys. He demonstrates his commitment to his community by serving as a mentor with the Big Brothers, Big Sisters, advisor to several UC Davis and Sacramento State student groups, immediate past president of the Sacramento chapter of the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, and an advocate for African-American students. Professionally, he is an accomplished higher education administrator, career coach, and community leader, and worked at the UC Davis for close to 12 years. There, he has served as the chairman of the African Faculty and Staff Association and member of the Restorative Justice Task Force, among other campus committees. Currently, he works as a communications director for a statewide educational nonprofit, and we'll be sure to talk a little bit more about that. He has a great love for the Lord and sharing God's word. As a minister, he serves faithfully at the Progressive Church of God in Christ. At Progressive, he serves as the president of the Singles Living Victoriously, president of the Young People's Willing Workers, He serves on the scholarship committee. He serves as the almond bearer to the pastor and member of the music department. He is currently the youth pastor and young adult ministry leader. He believes his life's mission is to empower others to tap into their God-given potential for the greater good of humanity. He was ordained in the Church of God in Christ in June of 2016. His passion for youth and young adults has provided many opportunities to serve. So with that, I'm going to introduce Dominique. I know you have a lot on your plate, and I really thank you for coming on the show today. Thank you for coming on, brother.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Mr. Brooks. I appreciate it.
Right, right. And I understand that you've got some other stuff to do today, so we won't keep you too long. But if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure, sure. I have been in Sacramento, in the Sacramento area, for about 15 years. I came here to work at UC Davis after doing some graduate studies at UC Davis. I really care about, and I think if I didn't have a bio, what I'd want people to know is that I'm really passionate about the development of youth, particularly black young men and black children. It's been a passion of mine since I and my brothers went through or survived or were engaged in the foster care system, and it's been a passion of mine to see young people matriculate and to pursue education and to be valued, respected, and particularly in the education system. So that's a little bit about who I am and what I do.
Oh, okay, okay. Now, tell us a little bit about came up in the foster care system there in, was it Seattle, Washington?
Yeah, Seattle and Portland.
Okay, okay. Seattle and Portland. And we hear so much about foster kids when they turn 18. You know, sometimes their lives can go either way. So when you matriculated out of the foster care system, tell us a little bit about that time of your life.
That represented a very difficult time in my life. A lot of the legislation around supporting foster youth was sort of in play. You all might be familiar with the work that Hillary Clinton was doing as the First Lady. A lot of the support for foster youth really ended at the age of 18. I turned 18 in the fall of my senior year in high school. So I had the unfortunate experience of navigating a senior year, but also trying to figure out how I would survive after graduating. Fortunately, the foster home that I was in and the system allowed for my foster mother to receive resources throughout my senior year. But a week after I graduated from high school, I essentially was emancipated and homeless and finding my way. Fortunately, I had a host of really awesome guidance counselors in high school, folks that were really committed to my success. And they, knowing the where my life would take me or change in a very short period of time, really worked hard to set me up for success academically. So I had $42 throughout that summer and tried to find work where I could and use that $42 to take a train from Seattle, Washington to Eugene, Oregon, where I pursued my undergraduate degree. So I'm thankful to God. Certainly the core of my experience and my success is because Christ had purpose for my life. So to an extent, I'm an anomaly But I'm also a testament to the power of God to transform lives, no matter where you come from, what type of family background you have.
Right, right. Now, how did you finance your way through through your first years of college? The University of Oregon, you say?
Yes, yes. That I was not privy to some, like I said, I wasn't privy to a lot of the resources for foster youth, and those were sort of in the development phases. Probably by the time that I was a sophomore, resources were more readily available, and once I tapped into resources that came as a result of being awarded the state, they call, I was able to get scholarships, and I successfully tried my hardest to compete academically, and I worked through my time at the University of Oregon, always kept a full-time job, as well as maintained my academics. So.
Right, right. Dominique, the University of Oregon, is that the Ducks?
Yes, sir. The University of Oregon, the Ducks, the one and only.
Okay, well, the University of Oregon, in my mind, is one of the top schools in the country.
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot about it. So apparently you must have been academically gifted or maybe above average to get in there. How did you get in?
The grace of God. I had a very interesting experience. I had applied for a number of historically black colleges and universities and intended to go to one of those. But I was not, at that time, information about financial aid, residence halls, and stuff like that wasn't as readily accessible as perhaps it would be at some of the more traditional institutions. And like I said, with $42, you cannot fly from Washington to the opposite side of the country. So my selection to the University of Oregon was because I was in Seattle, and I thought, I don't know if I want to be, in Washington for undergrad. So I thought the University of Oregon made the most sense. Once I spent that $42, there was no turning back.
I tell you what.
So they had me and I had them. We're stuck together.
So you essentially worked your way through college, and you took advantage of various grants, scholarships, and so forth?
Correct. Fortunate, because I was able to really tap into a lot of skills. I was a journalism major, so my work, I didn't work at a restaurant. I had the privilege of working in student government. I was a paid work at the Black Student Union, the Multicultural Center. To student government, and so I worked through college, but much of it was through work studies and different things that allowed me to be in the academic environment to pursue my education thoughtfully. So I was fortunate in that regard.
Right, right. So just to recap, right now you have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Maybe tell us a little bit about your education accomplishments.
Sure. I got a bachelor's degree from the University of Oregon. I completed that in 2003. I had this great passion to go to graduate school, but I didn't get accepted to any graduate schools right out of undergrad. I ended up working for a year as an admissions counselor at Southern Oregon University. And through that year, I found a passion for higher education and the study of emerging adults, and decided that that's what I wanted to pursue a graduate degree in. So I ended up going to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and completed there in 2006. And that landed me at the University of California, Davis, for my first job post graduate work, and then a number of years later, I decided to go back and pursue a Master's of Divinity at the Fuller Theological Seminary, and I'm kind of in the process of completing that. I'm very close and very much in need of prayer there.
Well, we'll keep you in prayer, Dominique. Now, UC Davis, folks, in case you don't know, the University of California in Davis is another top university. It's no Mickey Mouse University. So, Dominique, I must say that your educational path has taken you to some very good colleges.
Thank you. I'd agree.
Now, what did you do at UC Davis?
I did a lot of things.
Besides your degree.
Go ahead. I worked, and so I came to Davis to work in residence life, and I ran a residence hall area, and then I kind of moved on. I did some work managing a grant-funded program that was a pathway for HBCU students to pursue PhDs at the University of California institutions. Then I worked in human resources for a little bit and then ended there working with the College of Ag and Environmental Sciences, managing their recruitment and outreach efforts. So I had a lot of different jobs, a lot of them centered around student affairs, student engagement, student persistence, and matriculation.
Right. You know, I met you, got in touch with you, Dominique, because of your graphics ability. You made a flyer for my friend Ron Gilmore and myself, and when he showed me the flyer that you made, I said, wow, this is a very professional flyer here. Who is this guy? So he told me about you. And just anybody in our listening audience, if you have need for flyers or, I guess, graphics, I guess, Dominique, that might be one of your side hustles, helping people with their marketing flyers.
Yeah. I appreciate that. You know, I had mentioned some of my civic engagement and you know, working, being the president of the BSU and working in the Multicultural Center when I was an undergrad. And how I learned how to do graphic design was that it cost so much money for us to get other people to design things, or there was a lot of, like, kind of university bureaucracy. And so I was teaching myself how to make flyers just for some, you know, whether to make graphics. I literally taught myself via YouTube. And so that might be a little inspiration for folks, like, just to, and I've had the opportunity to make booklets and conference collateral and funeral programs, and all of it started because I couldn't find anybody to make a flyer when I was over the Black Student Union at the University of Oregon. So persistence work it can be a blessing in disguise.
Right. Well, now we're going to talk a little bit about your current job. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now? In your capacity with
Sure. I work for an organization called the Omoja Community Education Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization based in Sacramento, California, that serves over 70 community colleges in California and Washington. The purpose of the organization is to create community among African-American students at these institutions, and we have a real strong emphasis in faculty development. Our approach is that students are more successful, classrooms work better when there's an African-centered framework, and so we both charge our people to think more globally, about the ways that they educate, and we really borrow from practices and principles that come from the motherland, and we take those into academic spaces with administrators, practitioners, and students, and say, there's a better way to learn. There's a better way to ensure the matriculation and academic success of African-American students, and we provide those resources in the community. I happen to be able to speak in this matter because I'm the communications and development director, so my responsibility is outreach and marketing and fundraising. So from my vantage point, that's essentially what we do.
Right. Well, you pique my interest when you talk about African-centered education, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah, can you highlight a little bit on just
sure.
actually,
so,
I will say that's part of it, but.
Sure, I'd love to do that. Maybe about 10 years ago, a group of extremely concerned African-American faculty, staff, practitioners throughout the state of California got together, and they read a book by bell hooks called Teaching to Transgress. And the idea of that book was, you know, what are the ways that we have essentially handicapped African-American students because we have been teaching them from a Eurocentric mindset. We have told them that there's one way to learn, and we know the results of that, right? Kids are being expelled from school. They're not able to flourish because people are being employed to teach, but they're really more equipped to police and to manage students in classrooms than they are to really teach curriculum. So our philosophy is that there's a way to teach that highlights authenticity, and we have selected through our work, particularly with that book from bell hooks around Teaching to Transgress, 18 practices that we believe center Black students, Black communities, and Black families. And we say that if programs, institutions, community colleges throughout our state and beyond take these 18 practices, embrace them, and make them a part of their curriculum, the way that they experience their students, the way that they make and create space for their students on campuses, then students are more likely to be successful. And we've got statistics that prove that students who are more engaged, who see themselves and their faculty and practitioners, are more likely to succeed academically and personally.
All right. Can you tell us the name of bell hooks' book?
Teaching to Transgress.
Teaching
to Transgress.
What was that last part?
Teaching to Transgress. Teaching to Transgress. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, I was just noticing that she just passed on a few months ago.
I was just affirming. Yes, she just passed.
Oh yeah, yeah. So, her book. I'm in a little more. Tell us a little bit more about that. And how they use that as a model.
Okay. Well, I think that sometimes, like I said, I think that we, because of our Eurocentric way of teaching and learning, we've created academic systems that tell us that we have to police Black students, and the result is that people in academic spaces, they bring their sort of status quo, their Eurocentric way of thinking, their microaggressions, they bring all these things into the classroom space, and what it results in is higher suspension rates for Black students. It results in really just a culture that does not acknowledge the giftedness of Black students. So Bell Hooks, she essentially communicates in her book that education cannot be the pipeline to embedding in the heart and minds of black students what the prison system does, right? So, like, you do something, and then you get in trouble, and then you get suspended, and then as a result of doing something in an academic setting amongst people who are supposed to be educating you, they then become the people that police you, and then you get sent home, and you're no longer able to access the education that you deserve, that your parents or whomever pays taxes for you to attain. Bell Hooks said that actually the practice of education is the path to freedom. So everything about the process to the of accessing and understanding your capacity to learn, the environment where you do so, has everything to do with the way that you experience freedom, whether it's sometimes that freedom is physical freedom, mental, spiritual, social freedom, like the access that you have to education is in direct alignment with your ability to succeed in life. And you've heard that old saying where they say that if you want to hide something from a black person, put it inside of a book. Well, that is that's not something that's the product of a system that decided that was going to be the truth, right? So I don't understand Johnny's intellect. I don't understand the way that Johnny speaks or interacts with other people. And so since I don't understand it or like it, or it's not like I think it should be, I suspend him. Therefore, he doesn't have access to educational development and growth. And then it becomes a practice because this young child is indoctrinated to believe that who they are makes them unworthy of being educated, and in the long term makes them unworthy of experiencing freedom that comes through education. So essentially what Bell Hicks is saying in her book is that practitioners, educators, administrators, students, we all have this responsibility to understand education as the pathway, the gateway to freedom.
Oh, okay. Well, you piqued my interest. I'm going to have to read that. But we have a person that asked to come on in the 314 area code. Caller, would you state your name and where you're calling from?
This is Mr. Pianchi. How you doing, Jensen? This is a good story. And hello to your guest.
Huh?
Yeah, but I've heard this.
Yes, thanks for coming. Go ahead, Pianchi.
Yeah, I've heard this said before. If you're going to hide something from a black person, then you put it in a book. And I need some clarity on that. Pacific, who black? Because you take black Nigerians in this country, first, second, third generation, they have the highest academic attainment than any other ethnic group. And what is meant by teaching Eurocentric? I think that's the word you use. You might correct me. Exactly what does that mean? Give me some examples on both of those if you could.
Sure. So first of all, I did not coin the statement, if you want to hide something from black people, hide it in the book. And I also do not necessarily agree with the ideology. I think my point was that if that is true, it's something that's been embedded in the way that schools are taught to engage with black students. Because if you look at the rates for which African-American students are suspended K through 12, or the way that their behavior is managed in K through 12, you'll find that they are suspended at a higher rate than other students. And it's my understanding that Mr. Brooks had a guest that spoke to that last week. With regard to a Eurocentric ideology that centers the way that we teach, I'm currently reading a book by a gentleman by the name of Chris Emden. I believe he's a faculty member at USC. And in his book, he's got a book called Ratchedemic, In his book, he's calling for practitioners and teachers to center themselves in their own authenticity, and to teach from a pureness that is really about their essence and not about what they learned in graduate school or how they have been taught to engage students. And most of our institutions, their philosophy and ideologies around teaching and pedagogy, particularly in classrooms, is built in a system that doesn't take into consideration the way that Black youth learn. Right. And I think that a lot of educators would agree that what they learned about experiencing and navigating classrooms is centered in a white-centered framework. And so what Bell Hooks' ideology is she agreed with that. And she said that the goal of teaching was not to assimilate. The goal of teaching was not to become like the system. The goal of teaching is to experience your classroom as a pathway to freedom. I hope that answers your question.
Well, I don't quite agree with that. I think a child, you know, some of these schools in the urban area, and I've been dealing with the topic of the education of Black children since the 1970s, and 72 in particular with Bedford Stuy in New York. But these schools are school districts are ran by Black administrators, Black boards, heavily populated, and I can name quite a few. And actually, in many states, in particular Missouri, where the state statutes specifically state, and by the way, they just passed another law in Missouri, which gives that the board has listened to the parents, which they should have been doing anyway. But to go on, the state statute of Missouri say whatever the books, curriculum, and teacher instruction, whatever that is up to the school district itself. And that the state Board of Education and the State Department of Education has nothing to tell them. They cannot mandate. So is it not the parents? These are Black districts. We can't say they're white that's doing this. And also when you talk about learning about, you made mention about the gentleman and wanting him to teach where he, well, he's an American citizen. So would not what he grew up around, would that not be the culture of one of many, of course, in the United States itself?
Let me go back to something that you said earlier that I think is important. 67% of all school administrators are white, and only 11% of those administrators, according to the United States Department of Education, are African American. If you look at those statistics in communities and in school districts that are primarily African American, Black, or Brown, there is a bit of a conflict. I don't argue that there are some phenomenal African American administrators in school districts and places across the country. In fact, I have the privilege of serving as a member of a board for a K-12 institution that is ran by an amazing cadre of Black administrators. My point is that there is a difference between who runs the school and who sets the curriculum and where the curriculum comes from. And I think that just as to your point, we cannot say that all of school districts are ill-equipped and are teaching from a Eurocentric framework. We also have to agree that if you're in a school district that is 67% white, with students that are majority Black and Brown, there is a dissidence. There is a gap in the way that allow me to finish if you don't mind.
Yeah.
There is a gap in the way that they learn. My early remarks about Bell Hooks and Chris Emden, I'm just simply sharing the research and the outcomes of their research as manifested through their books. I experienced that, just as you noted, both as an educator, as an advocate for young people, but also as a student who did not come from a community where African Americans were centered and supported and affirmed. So I think it's very difficult. And then you had mentioned the role of parents. My foster mother was in her 60s when I was in high school, and there was a lot of things that she did not have the capacity to do as a foster parent with a house with up to 8 boys. And so a part of my passion for education is I like that that idea that has been sort of recycled over time, that it takes a whole village to raise a child. A part of the village mindset has to be that we educate ourselves about what's happening in the academic system, and it sounds like that's something that you have done as well. And I think that we need a holistic approach, and I think that's what Bell Hooks is talking about. Whether it be teaching at home or teaching in school, it really starts higher than the teacher that's hired to teach for America. It starts in the way that teachers are taught to teach.
Well, I hear you. I don't agree with Bell Hooks, because the school districts that I know, St. Louis, those in St. Louis County, you look at Detroit, where 60 Minutes done a documentary called A National Disgrace. Those not the white teachers, no white administrators. I was a member of the National Black United Front, now that the field director for African Center Curriculums in St. Louis metropolitan area. And even I backed off of those, because I've seen schools that had those type of curriculums or quote-unquote tried to, and the students still did not academically perform. Now, you had some cases where they did, but overall they do not. So say that 67% of the administrators that's teaching in black school districts, well, why do they call it a black school district? It's just not true. And then it gets to the point where it's up to the parents in that district. Like in Normandy School District there in St. Louis County on the outskirts of St. Louis, they hired a person as a superintendent, had no superintendent experience whatsoever. And I understand that he finally resigned. But it still goes back to the people, the parents. The parents has to make sure that that child is being educated, and the school board need to follow the direction and the wishes of the parents, not come up with some curriculum that comes from Australia or wherever, unless they want that. But they'll still are those children belong to the parents. If the parents don't want critical race theory taught in their school to their children, then that's their prerogative, and it should be followed. And I see cases where the parents do have that type of input, no matter what type of demographics is sitting in the classroom, whether it's all black, all Somalian, all Russian, or all white. You see that is a situation where that child do perform pretty well. So I have to back off, and I just don't agree with what you're saying based on the things that I've seen. But people write books, and I appreciate your story. It seemed like you overcame all the odds and didn't use a lot of the excuses that I hear people use. And it comes down to perseverance and also sacrifice and dedication and care. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate your commentary. It sounds like you do agree with Bell Hooks, however, though, because what you're saying parents should use their power to do with regard to influencing the classroom is exactly what Bill Hooks is saying. So I do, I think also too that I want to just address the idea that people who have had the same experiences as I have had might be using excuses. I think as you can imagine, like we're all, especially as adults, like the product of childhood trauma, right? And we experience difficulty in life as a result of the things that we perhaps haven't been exposed to the capacity to really heal from. And so my work is both to be an example, but not to use my experience or my story to alienate people's ability. And I think a part of that is navigating the fact that when life is hard, like it really takes a lot to get out from under what the system and all the things that particularly Black men have to war against in order to experience success. And so I just love the intergenerational discourse, and I love the idea, particularly as a youth pastor, I love the idea of really empowering parents to become engaged in the curriculum for which their students are exposed to. But at the same time, we also must be conscious of the fact that there is systemic racism and sexism that is warring against every effort that we have to ensure that a school experience for our children is a platform for freedom. And I think it's really important for us to really dive deep into that so that we can help not just our students, but teachers and administrators and those who will come in the future.
Yes, Dominique, you have a passion about the development of young Black men. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, that and how you facilitate with your group or your church?
Sure. I think for me, it's really just experiential. I think about being a young Black man in foster care, the experiences that I had both from my foster father and the men in my family, but also when my foster mother determined that I needed additional support, she tapped into Big Brothers Big Sisters. And I was fortunate enough to have a big brother who exposed me to a lot of things. One in particular was being a part of a fraternity. My big brother, although he was a member of Omega Psi Phi, he exposed me to a culture of excellence that Black men have that was very, very transformative for me and really was a part of the reason why I pursued college. So my work with young Black men and young adults is really to lead, first of all, by example, to really just share my own story and the possibility through, of course, education, but most importantly through Christ. And I've had the privilege to do that through Big Brothers Big Sisters, through the work that my fraternity, Alpha Phi Alpha, is doing, particularly in Sacramento, through the Sacramento Alpha Academy that takes place, was taking place at Consumers River College prior to the pandemic. A lot of different opportunities. Any opportunity that I personally can get to inspire young Black men, I think it's not just a passion, but it's an obligation. So there's some days that I don't feel passionate about it, but I am called to that work, and so it requires sacrifice. So I think that it's a mandate, is something that God has called me to do.
Right. Help kids get into college, I believe, and the college higher education retention. Is that associated with Emoji Community Education Foundation?
So, yeah, professionally, I've been an admissions counselor, and I've managed at UC Davis the retention and recruitment efforts In my current position, Umoja does have very strong partnerships with four-year institutions where we encourage students to transfer from two-year institutions to four-year institutions and then also to pursue graduate education.
Oh, okay. Do you have anything that you would like to share with the audience today, anything on your heart that you want to just make sure we talk about or you discuss or share?
Sure. I just want to thank you for this platform and the opportunity to talk about things that your listeners and your guests are passionate about. I think this is awesome. I also am grateful for the opportunity to have discourse with members of the community about things, and I think that it's a beautiful thing. Whether we agree or don't agree, I think the discourse and the opportunity to communicate cross-generationally is really, really important to our development as a community. I have a podcast called Season with Salt. It is a podcast that is named after a scripture in the Bible that says that our words should be seasoned with salt so that we know how to answer every man. And the reason why I created that podcast is because I found that in religious circles, there were some topics that people were afraid to really address, and sometimes it's primarily just generational, and it's the platform that the Lord gave me to really think beyond the four walls of church when it comes to issues that are important to young people, young adults, and to essentially all people. So if you're looking for a new podcast to listen to, I'd encourage you to check out I have a website that is DominiqueBomonte.com. My name is very hard to spell. But you can also go to my podcast website, which is seasonwithsaltpodcast.com. I really just enjoy discourse. I've certainly enjoyed this discussion and certainly Mr. Brooks getting to know you, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you for coming on the show today. Let's talk a little bit about you are in the ministry, and I would like if you would share a little bit about your involvement into the ministry.
Sure. I was called to the ministry when I was 9 years old and had the opportunity as a very young person to preach and to really connect to my spiritual calling, which is, I think, an amazing thing, especially when people can tap into their calling at young ages and be affirmed by their family and people around them. I think it does wonders for them. And as a young person that had not received a lot of affirmation, the opportunity to preach and to share God's word at a young age was really valuable to me and really established my confidence in myself and certainly in God. However, when I was in high school, I got tired of being referred to as preacher boy, and I had this mindset that I wanted to be regular. I wanted to be like other people. And that pursuit of being regular and not being teased for being a preacher really led me in a different path that was not in alignment with who God called me to be. When I went to grad school, pretty much through undergrad, I did not go to church at all. A part of that was a disengagement and kind of anger because the foster home that I had grown up in was heavily religious, but I had a lot of anger about the ways that my final year in foster care evolved, and I projected a lot of that in church because when I would go back, you know, and be in community with some of those people, I didn't like the way that they treated me or the way that they spoke to me. And it was really ammunition to really pursue success, but it turned me off from church. In graduate school, however, by the time I was 24 or 25, I had gone to Las Vegas, and people were saying, oh, that's Sin City. You're going to have to be careful. Like, you got to find a church. And the Lord led me to a church while I was there. What happened was I started fighting against this urging to go back into the ministry. So after graduate school, when I came to, I had reclaimed my life and given my life to the Lord, but finished graduate school and moved to California, I still had this sort of disinterest in church, but I felt God pulling me to pursue ministry. I ended up joining a church in Sacramento that, and I thought the pastor's academic acumen and the way that he navigated the word was just so impressive to me that I wanted to learn more about him. And he happened to ask me to serve as an armor bearer one day in the parking lot at a church that we were ministering at. And it really propelled me to, like, really watch his ministry and be inspired by the way that he led the community, the way that he prepared and preached his discipline. And after a while, like, it was the Lord was like, okay, I'm not going to keep giving you chances. So in about 2015, I yielded to the Lord and re-accepted my call to the ministry and gotten ordained. And God has really been faithful to me. I feel to a certain extent that even though sometimes I feel very guilty about not just leaving the ministry, but leaving God for those years that I was in undergrad and the anger and all that, I really feel that that really propels me to be a stronger advocate for youth and young adults through ministry, because I know what it feels like to be disengaged and to be outcasted and to be treated like an outsider in spaces that you're supposed to belong. Through that experience, God has really opened doors for me to be able to minister to youth and particularly young adults. And so that's sort of my ministry trajectory, where I've been able to really grow in the ministry. And I'm thankful to my church and my pastor, Dr. B.L. Tolliver, who have really pushed me, encouraged me. You mentioned Elder Gilmore, and you've had him on your show before. He's somebody that just really inspires me and encourages me and certainly prays for me, and I'm grateful for just the relationship with older men who have been in the place that I am and who have a passion for their personal calling to ministry, but also to entrepreneurial efforts, to their family, and to their community.
Oh, okay. You remind me a little bit of the prodigal son.
Okay, I'll take that. He came home. That's it. His coming home is certainly something that I identify with.
Yes, sir. But apparently you didn't go through all of the trauma that I guess you might say lowness that maybe the prodigal son when he left the father's house, or did you?
Well, I don't know. I think we skipped that part, but yeah, I'm gonna say yes. but you know, and that's why I was kind of pushing back on the idea that people make excuses, because trauma and life can be so hard. It's really hard to get around some of this stuff. It really takes a relationship with God. And yes, I've had some low lows and some high highs, but God has been faithful.
Right. So your work with the youth and young people, what are some of the issues as you see it that they're going through these days? We've got about another 5 minutes. Maybe you could share a little bit about your work in the youth and young persons ministry at your church.
sure. Well, youth of today, they have similar ways that they are provoked and peer pressured, but the issues for which they experience are a lot different from previous generations. And I'd say that their mechanisms for coping are a lot different. Issues that I see, particularly amongst young people, there's a lot of cutting or self-mutilization or self-harm. There is a lot of drug use. Of course, we know the statistics for the misuse of prescription drugs is very high. Even last week, I had the opportunity to share with my church the impact of fentanyl on the community, the relationships, interpersonal relationships, they're being pulled in so many different ways. Of course, there is sex trafficking and a lot of these really deep and dark demonic relationships and issues really begin by the pursuit of wanting to be needed and valued and seen and heard and affirmed, and the parents' capacity or the village from which surround young people being able to do that effectively. And then there are some young people that are affirmed and come from strong environments where they are encouraged and inspired, and they still are exposed to drugs and alcohol and a lot of different issues. And so a part of my community work is really exposure. As a person called to the ministry and called to youth ministry, the work is both exposure, mentorship, and the work of causing parents and youth influencers to know that youth can be delivered and saved and set free through the power of Christ Jesus. But also it takes education, it takes mentorship, it takes checking in, it takes a really more intense effort to be a part of young people's lives. And some of that is our investment in youth's potential, our investment in their passion, their dreams, what they want to accomplish in life. All of it has to do with the way that we enact. So in my ministry, I teach simple concepts like, you know, youth are members. I don't care if they're 3 or 3 months or 30. If they're members of a church, they're members of a church, and they should be treated. They should have the same access. They should have the same engagement. They should have the same opportunities, because I believe that church is a platform that can really save a generation of young people. So that's just a little bit about my work and my philosophy where ministry is concerned for you.
Okay. Right. Well, we got about another minute and a half. Certainly thank everybody for listening today, and certainly thank our guest, Brother Dominique Bumante. Dominique, we'll have to have you on the show again. Maybe we can talk about one of the specific topics that you're into, whether it be your nonprofit, or whether it would be with your church, or some other topic that we might deal with, maybe education. But thanks again for coming on the show today. And
absolutely.
Folks, if you're listening right now, the number to call is 516-387-1611 every Saturday, 10 o'clock a.m. Pacific Standard Time. God willing, we'll be here next Saturday with another good guest. And would you like to give your you've got about 30 seconds, your website?
Yes, seasonedwithsaltpodcast.com, or my name, DominiqueBomonte.com, seasonedwithsalt, no spaces, podcast.com.
All right, all right. With that, we'll just say we'll wrap it up for today. Everybody have a nice weekend, and God willing, we'll see you next week, same time.
God bless you.
God bless you, too.